Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series, which you can find on iTunes and YouTube. This episode features audio from the closing plenary of the 2018 Left Forum, held June 1st through 3rd in New York City, entitled A Vision Moving Forward. The first speaker is Ajamu Baraka, who was the Green Party vice presidential candidate in 2016. Ajamu Baraka is a national organizer and national spokesperson for the Black Alliance for Peace and a Black Agenda Report editor. The second speaker is Kali Okuno, co-founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson, an organization whose website states they are building a solidarity economy anchored by a network of cooperatives and other type of worker-owned and democratically self-managed enterprises. The third speaker is Bhairavi Desai, founding member of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, a union representing approximately 15,000 taxi drivers in New York City. And now, Ajamu Baraka. I should note that a dozen or so people out of the hundreds present walked out at the start of Ajamu's talk to protest his opposition to U.S. intervention in Syria, and some of his comments are in reference to this.
As you can see, with all of the very serious issues we have to face here in this country in building a viable left, we tend to get confused by who the enemy is. But I think that we are absolutely clear what we have to do here. We've got to organize ourselves. We've got to make sure that we keep the focus on the real enemy. Because basically, we have a certain responsibility here as residents and citizens at the center of empire. Our responsibility, no matter what we think about what's happening around the world, in any particular nation state, our responsibility is to put a brake on U.S. imperialism. So we are clear about that in the Black Alliance for Peace. We talk about peace, but we're not talking about bourgeois peace. We understand that without justice, there will be no peace. And we understand that to have justice, we have to fight for it. So in terms of how we see going forward and strategies for going forward, we are building this new formation, the Black Alliance for Peace. Its tagline is that it is a people-centered human rights project against war, repression, and imperialism. We say that if there's going to be an anti-war movement in this country, and it must be, that movement has to be also anti-imperialist. So we are clear about that in the Black Alliance for Peace. We're also clear as we go forward that we have to name the enemy. We see the Black Alliance for Peace as an integral part of the restructuring and reorganization of the Black Liberation Movement. This particular formation is part of that battlefield, if you will, that battlefront on this issue. We say that we have to name the enemy, and for us, the enemy is and remains the white supremacist, colonial, capitalist patriarchy. We say that if we're going to organize a left here in this country, we've got to name the enemy, have clear politics, and not be afraid to, in fact, push those politics. We say that at this point in history, there could be no confusion. We can't sugarcoat the fact that this system is in decline. But this system is also a very dangerous one. Therefore, we can't pretend that reform is even possible. We have to be honest with the people. Tell no lies. And let people understand that the future that we are fighting for is going to be a future in which the kind of privileges we have in this country, even among workers, is going to have to change. Because we understand that those privileges have been based on the systematic exploitation and oppression of the world. And as the people of the world organize themselves and begin to take hold of their futures, begin to assert their own self-determination and national liberation, that the impact on that here in the North, in the U.S., and in Europe is that the privileges and lifestyles of the labor aristocracy, of the petty bourgeoisie, those privileges, that lifestyle will not be the same. So we must be clear about that and honest with the people. So as we go forward, we say that we have to have certain commitments in terms of how we organize the work. First, we have to recognize that one of the issues that we've got to have front and center is the issue of being opposed to war and U.S. imperialism. We have to have clear politics and have the confidence in the people to push those politics. And we can't be afraid of that S word, socialism. We have to be able to envision and to advance that vision. We can't just talk about what we are opposed to. It's not enough to have clear analysis. We have to have a vision that presents a real alternative. And the only alternative that I see, and I think most of you see, for us to address the issues that face humanity is a socialist revolution. And we can't be afraid to say that. We have to revive anti-imperialism. We know that there's a lot of confusion here in this country and even in Western Europe around how we should approach this question. We've got to be clear, my friends, and say that, you know, no matter what we might think about what's happening in various nations, we've got to be clear about what our responsibilities are. We had a marvelous panel this morning where we talked about and looked at the situation in Venezuela. Very, very good conversation. We looked at the various social forces, the various interests that are clashing. We place that within the context of global capitalism and the international balance of forces. Very good conversation. But one thing that we also did that was important, we said no matter what our different perspectives and positions may be on that experience in that country, we recognize, though, that when it comes to the attempts by this state to destabilize that experience, to intervene into their historical process, we recognize that our responsibility was to oppose that. So we have to revive anti-imperialism if we're going to go forward and build a viable left here in this country. To do that, we have to centralize certain issues. War, as I said, is one very important issue. We also have to look at this issue of militarism. In the Black Alliance for Peace, we are anti-war, anti-imperialism, but we connect that up with our concerns and our objectives to struggle against militarism domestically, against repression domestically. We look at issues like so-called gun control, and we say to the young people, we understand why you are taking your positions. But if you're concerned about so-called gun control and arms, connect that to a concern against war and aggression externally and domestically. We say we have to make those connections if we're going to be morally and politically consistent. We say join us, young people, in opposing the Department of Defense's 1033 program that transfers equipment from the U.S. military to these police forces. We say, stand with us, young people, to oppose war and aggression across the globe. You can't be concerned about lies in the U.S. and not speak out about the brutality that we see in Gaza, in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We've got to be morally and politically consistent. So this issue of war and militarism has to be front and center. Lastly, economic human rights. We say that most of the issues that we see that our people are struggling with stems from the fact that most people are denied their basic fundamental human rights. That most people in this country are denied the ability to realize their full humanity, to be free of the fear of being unemployed, not having a way to pay your bills and to feed your family and feed yourself, not having a house to go to, not knowing where you're going to lay your head for millions of people in this country, not knowing whether or not you're going to be able to feed yourself, being afraid of getting sick because you don't have insurance, being exposed to pollutants in the air and in the ground. These are the elements that are being denied most people in this country. And we have to put that denial front and center as we organize here in this country. So economic human rights is an issue that I think all of us can agree on. So my friends, as we go forward, as we build this movement, as we attempt to live up to our responsibilities as citizens of the world, but in particular here in this empire, let us do this with the security of knowing that we are on the right side of history. That to build this movement is going to require struggle, debate, but we have no other choice but to, in fact, build this movement. The people of this country are waiting for that, and definitely the people of the world are waiting for us to get our act together here in this country. So we build, my friends, not based on what we can imagine. We build on what we have in hand in terms of our human material and the objective conditions. But we build, we organize, we struggle, and we're going to win. Thank you, my friends.
All right.
You're listening to episode 10 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from Ajamu Baraka, National Spokesperson for the Black Alliance for Peace. Next up is Kali Akuno, co-founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson.
I know many of you may want and expect like a whole analysis around Jackson, and we can maybe get into some of that. But I want to start on, since this is about moving forward, move beyond the experiment that we are engaging with on the short end, and talk about some of the things I think we need to be looking at collectively in the long term. That our little project in Jackson, Mississippi is in part focused on. And there's two pieces I want to really focus on. One is the striving towards eco-socialism as a solution to two crises. One, the profound economic and social crisis that we've all been subjected to as a result of capitalism and imperialism the last 500 years. But the latter one is the ecological crisis, which threatens to just wipe all complex life on this planet out. And some of us in our local work have decided to give that more focus in urgency. And what brings that up is not something abstract, it's actually something very concrete. And that's the experience many of us had with Hurricane Katrina. And now you see even more so the effects of that and what's happening in Puerto Rico as more and more of that is becoming uncovered and unraveled. That the catastrophe level stage of climate change is it's already been upon us. For some of us, we recognized that 12 years ago, and for others, you may have been even further back. But we're at that stage, and we have to build, in our view, a political movement that takes it seriously and is grounded in a practice which is actually going to build a way out of that particular dimension of the crisis. Now, with that, another major piece that I think many of us have tried to ground a practice in is how do we actually reconstitute the working class under the new conditions towards the project of emancipation, right? And that project must include dealing with the special issues of national oppression, race, gender, sexuality, ability as central pieces towards the emancipatory project. But I think for us, we have to recognize in the era that we are at, some of the methods that we've used in the past, particularly in this country, to try to organize our communities, you know, be it at the workplace and be it some other areas, the dynamic of neoliberalism basically underwrote those things about 30, 40 years ago. And we've been kind of hanging on to some of these forms just because we often don't want to think out the box or don't know what else to do. And I think that there are a number of different things that we need to really reinvent on. And that's a grounding piece of what our work around Jackson has really been focused on. It started in part with what Ajamo said, picking up on the theme. Like, you know, where are we concretely at? What do we concretely have? And then asking ourselves some new questions. And the thing that first forced many of us, you know, who wind up developing the Jackson-Cush plan, the thing that really forced us to start asking some new questions, first and foremost, the major catalytic force, was September 11th. And why? Because we were very clear that that was going to be a turning point domestically, that the terror that, you know, the United States has been reigning on the world for most of the last 100 years was going to be inwardly focused in a new and more profound way. Not that it hasn't been that way before. You know, actually almost any black person in here about that, they'll tell you. But we knew it was going to intensify in some critical ways, and that meant that we had to do our work in some profoundly different ways and change up a number of different things. Now, we didn't solve that all in like one piece. It was kind of experimental over the course of the next years. And then it was Hurricane Katrina that really brought us into a focus in on what could those of us who were working on that plan, what could we do concretely and where? That's what really led us to Jackson, Mississippi. It was an analysis, a concrete analysis based on a plan and based on some organizing history and work. But it wasn't just in terms of what I mean by looking and asking ourselves some new questions. It started off with what are the strengths that already exist in that community organically? And then what could we do to a certain extent to enhance upon that? Now, many people might, you know, take that to mean kind of old school organizing thing where you start with what the people want and you start with. We started in a little different dimension of saying, like, there are a number of different things that are already there, particularly in the realm of, like, the solidarity economy, which are not formally organized but which are necessary for the people in those conditions as they exist in Mississippi to actually survive. And nobody came and taught people how to share with each other, you know, be it paying your somebody's phone bill, your cousin's phone bill, your mama paying your utility bill. Nobody taught us those things. Those are things that were happening organically because they were necessary for our people's survival. And the thing that we asked ourselves, well, how do we take that particular element of solidarity that already exists, move it from an informal practice to a formal practice, and then use that as political leverage to change the economy? That's a core piece of what became a cornerstone of how we articulate the solidarity economy and some of the things that we wanted to start with. And I'm bringing that up as an example because I think we're going to have a new vision going forward. We got to ask ourselves some new questions that lead us into some new practices of how we are actually engaging and building power. Now, that don't mean you throw everything old out. I'm not saying that in the least, right? But we have to look at some of the things that we pursue as to what end does it actually serve. And so I'm going to speak to that piece around some of our focus around electoral politics. Now, we know historically on the left, this question around electoral politics in the United States has been and is going to continue to be a divide. But I think if we ask ourselves in a particular sense, to the degree that we're pursuing electoral offices within this empire, where we know the fundamental rules of the game and the structure are not going to change, what is the actual agency that the people that we might put in those places, what might they actually have? What might they actually do? And how do we shift the locus? And that brings me to the third. I'm trying to go through the different elements of the little program that we built and ask on the basis of the questions that we've kind of focused and shaped. And that's what we feel ultimately we have to build an alternative set of institutions that practice democracy on a participatory and the grassroots level to be a real leverage and a counter, a dual power, I'm going to use that up front, to the state as it actually exists in this country and in this empire. Because it's at that level that we're going to build, I think, the constituted force to be able to transform the society. And to think that we're going to do that through the instrument of the Democratic Party or we're going to do that through the instrument of the Green Party, I'm going to just say up front, I think, is ludicrous. Now, that doesn't mean those tools can't be used to push little pieces forward of what our overall agenda is. But if we think they're going to be the housing element of where we put all of our energy and attention, I think we're going down the wrong path. And the path is how do we actually enable the overall capacity of our people with a concrete program which is towards, aimed directly towards not only, you know, possessing and controlling the means of production, but doing it in such a way that it's regenerative of the ecology and the environment. Now, ain't nobody in this world figured it out exactly how to do that yet. But we have to ask ourselves some new questions. How do we struggle to do production, distribution, consumption, recycling in such a way that constitutes an organic whole that is replenishing the earth and not depleting it from it? And we got to take that particular task, I would argue, seriously. Because I think, you know, by all accounts, the clock is ticking real fast. And we better, you know, step up to the challenge of addressing it and dealing with the rabid nature of imperialism at this stage of the game, which is fully prepared to eliminate all those that it deems to be totally dispensable, which is becoming the vast majority of humanity. Right? As one of my, you know, comrades and co-workers said, there's a whole bunch of useless eaters on the planet now as far as the system is concerned. And ultimately, you know, there are programs that they're going to have to institute to balance that out. And that's why we would argue there, you know, there's some serious conversations that are had amongst elements of the ruling class that you all know about how do you do population, you know, reduce the population and those things. We got to take that serious, just as serious we got to take them trying to go to the moon and go to Mars, right? Like, that's not a speculative activity. Because what that says to me on a certain level, and I'll end here, that these folks, rather than deal with the contradictions of the system here, they'd rather leave us all burning in hell and take a private party with their friends to Mars and perpetuate the madness there. And that constitutes a legitimate discussion and program that's happening right now. Think about that. I want y'all to really think about that. Elon Musk is running around talking about this like this is a legitimate pursuit. And we just accept it like, okay, well, you know, I guess Star Trek is real or, you know, we at that stage of the game. He ain't talking about taking you along. Ain't none of us going to be on that. But he's going to take all of our resources, him and his friends are going to take all of our resources and our labor to make that possible if we enable them to do that. So I think there's a serious task that we have in front of us. Now, I think the basic elements that we say that need to be combined, number one, we have to really reunite the solidarity economy with what poses as the labor movement in this country. The bridge between those two pieces basically has to end. We definitely need to struggle with all our folks in the formal organized labor union movement in this country to recognize that the National Labor Relations Act regime is basically done, is finished, and we're going to have to fight on some new terms and recognize, in part, the opportunity that getting out of that shell actually presents to us in a number of different ways. And then the other thing I think we're going to definitely have to fight for is a much more radical-oriented independent politics, right, with an independent agenda that represents our collective interests, and then marry that with that grassroots political force and that dual power that we need to be building in all our neighborhoods, street by street, block by block. I think that is a concrete road to the future that we could all employ based upon the different conditions we face in either in the urban environments that we're in or the rural environments that we're in to build some concrete power that's transformative towards a radical agenda. So I'll end with that.
You're listening to episode 10 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from Kali Okuno, co-founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson. Next up is Bhairavi Desai, founding member of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance.
I do just want to say one thing that's really important to me about the introduction of where I work, the Taxi Workers Alliance. We are the organization that in January of 2017 struck at JFK taxi lot in opposition to the Muslim ban. Yeah. It was an amazing moment for us. We had no idea that the world was watching. We're out there protesting. We got back home at like 1, 2, 3 in the morning and realized that Delete Uber was trending nationally because while our members were out on strike, of course, you know, Uber dropped its rates to encourage people to go out to the airport. But, you know, one backstory to that strike for us is it was only possible because it wasn't our first one, right? We'd had many strikes at the airport before. And the reason we went out on strike at the airport taxi lot that day, when we saw the protesters gathering at the terminal, we knew that we needed to do something to give support to the protesters. And we believe that if we shut down the airport lot, that the police forces of the Port Authority would be completely divided. And we knew that because just about 5-6 months prior to the strike on that day, we had also shut down Kennedy Airport. I mean, there was no media, there were no cameras there at the time. But we had actually shut down Kennedy Airport, the taxi lines, because one of our members, we were getting ready for a demonstration the next day in front of the governor's office. And one of our members who was leafleting to fellow drivers and in the middle of his shift while his taxi was parked in the lot, was assaulted by a group of dispatchers. And then the cops came in and went to arrest him. And so we shut down the lot. We had dozens of our members. And it's a huge lot that holds up to 700 taxis at one time. So there's hundreds of drivers there. And, you know, many of our members sat on the ground and wouldn't let any of the taxis out. And within minutes, right, Port Authority had the entire lot surrounded by tow trucks, and there were dogs, and there were, you know, cops in riot gear. It was just us to defend ourselves in that moment. And so we knew that if we were to shut it down again, that the police would not know how to respond to us and respond to the protesters at the terminal at the same time. And I have to say, in all our years of organizing, I mean, that moment, when I think about what should the labor movement look like in our country, I can't help but to feel like in that moment, the courage and the vision of our members that shut down that lot really answered that question for me in such a profound way. After the Arab Spring, right, unions across the Arab world had this like amazing rise in membership, right? Like there were unions talking about how they couldn't keep up with the number of folks that wanted to sign. And that's because for folks in the Arab world, they could connect those movements, the democracy and liberation movements could be directly connected to the role that unions had played in civil society in really difficult times, but also the role that they had played, at the time of the Arab Spring itself. But in the U.S., we don't have that kind of an analogy. I mean, you would have, you know, during the Occupy movement, for example, many folks would have thought that we would have seen a rise in union membership, right? I mean, first of all, it would be hard to see those numbers because, you know, as Kali was saying, too much of the union movement is dependent on the National Labor Relations Board telling us whether or not we have members. That the members only get counted once you're able, you know, to win a contract or, you know, to win an election. But really, not even then. It's really when you're able to win the contract. In other words, when the bosses have been forced to come to the table to recognize you. But that's not what should give you recognition. What makes a union is, you know, it's an organization that's democratically organized and represented by the workers who have come together to defend themselves. And that could be outside of the NLRB, as we've been doing for 22 years, or even if it's within the recognition of the NLRB. And I don't want to downplay how important collective bargaining is and how important that recognition needs to be, not for the sake of the union, but for the sake of maintaining our civil society and even, you know, the illusions of democracy. But even when you have that recognition, if the workers aren't the ones that are controlling their organization and their destiny, you know, and their rights within that local economy in that industry, that's not a union. That's a collective bargaining agent. And I would argue that they really are two different things. You know, union to me, you know, it's the more political, it's the more ideological definition of what it means for workers to come together and fight for their own self-determination. So, you know, at the end of the Occupy movement or throughout the Occupy movement, we couldn't count all these numbers because we don't have a union, an organized union movement that understands that we need to find new ways of calculating our membership and understanding the level of support, you know, grassroots worker support that we as workers' organizations have. But we also couldn't calculate those numbers because the reality is there was a large disconnect between, you know, a grassroots movement by activists, by, you know, primarily young activists, right, and organized labor. Organized labor was not at the heart of that movement. Or there were many organizations, many labor unions that I think did great work in supporting Occupy, but of course, we as a labor movement have absolutely no claim in saying that we were at the heart of why Occupy happened. Similarly, when you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, if any, which I think is probably the most important grassroots movement, certainly in my generation, you know, you don't see a connect. Yeah. We still don't see that connect, right? That translates into either a membership that broadens out the labor movement or even a more of an ideological shift within the labor movement itself that has got to recognize that racism and capitalism are two sides of the same coin. And unless we as a left, you know, are push ourselves to have those conversations that recognizes the ways in which racism is so deeply entrenched in our society and in our economy, we will fail to rebuild our society. And of course, for me, when I think of those two sides of that coin, the name of that coin is imperialism. And yet, you know, we have a labor movement that doesn't challenge itself on these larger social ideological questions. Instead, we're too busy being bureaucrats and technocrats, right? Which is even when we look at the split between the AFL and Change to Win all those years ago was about. It was an internal power play. It was not an ideological shift, which is really what we need in the labor movement. First and foremost, we need a labor movement that's politically independent from the Democratic Party. I mean, we as a, you know, as a movement, right, you know, as an institution right now, we end up really being a lapdog to that party, a party that in so many ways has sold its soul to Wall Street, you know, and I mean, there's an important internal struggle that's going on within the party that we in the left have to push, right? Because well, if we don't push for those internal debates, then the party is only going to move even further to the right. And so I think it's important that we have that. But I also think it's important that unless the labor movement is seen as its own independent political vehicle, it will always get used by the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party will have absolutely no reason to genuinely distance itself from Wall Street and all the titans of capital. The labor movement has such an... It's not only a necessity that the Democratic Party distance itself from Wall Street, but really the labor movement can be the catalyst to make that happen. We still are the most organized force of people in this society. The labor movement has tremendous power. The problem is that it has been for far too long a tool of capital rather than being a vehicle of change, particularly for the working class. And I know that so well just from the day-to-day grassroots that we do, you know, work that we do in our industry. I mean, where companies like Uber, which represent less than 1% of the economy, but in more than half the states across the country, they have one deregulation bill where if you are a worker and the boss is an app company, you can no longer be considered an employee. And these are not all Republican-dominated states by any stretch of the imagination. And so... In order to rebuild the labor movement in this country, obviously, you know, there's no doubt that means it has to be a labor movement that is based on class-conscious unionism and not on business unionism. And so that means that we need that left, you know, that those of us who come from the left and are part of the labor movement, we have to find more ways of engaging the movement that we are a part of. And we need a left that supports that effort. We cannot have a left in this country that is either confused around issues of imperialism or is really blind to the significance and the role of labor. And there are too many left spaces where that does happen. Just because it's an institution itself that is deeply problematic, you know, and flawed, it does not mean that the labor movement as a whole is something that we should take for granted. The left needs to find ways to inject new organizing and you know, have more young activists join the labor movement. You know, we need to take that movement over because it's still the biggest vehicle of change that we have within this economy and, you know, really within our society. And I think when the disconnect happens from the Democratic Party, you'll also see a labor movement that begins to invest more in organizing, in grassroots organizing, and not so much, you know, in the top-down business unionism that you see of today. And just really, very lastly, I just want to say that I think part of the point that Kali was making, and I think Kathy as well, it's true that when we think of the labor movement, you know, we often focus on, you know, the large institutions, the big unions and the federation. I happen to be a board, you know, an executive committee member of the AFL-CIO. We were the first non-traditional union that was chartered actually by the AFL-CIO for membership. But really, I think what we have to focus on is a broader working class movement that also looks at, you know, grassroots organizing like by worker centers, which are doing some of the most confrontational, anti-capitalist, you know, militant organizing that's out there. And they are part of the reason And, you know, that organizing is part of the reason that you see a pressure on local unions, maybe not at the national level, but on local unions to become more militant and class conscious and to be more democratically organized, you know, at the local level. And so we need to also support more work by worker centers and push worker centers to be more membership driven and to be more mass-based driven, because, you know, we can't have a disconnect where the largest mass-based organizations in our country are so depoliticized, which is just a fancy way of saying that they're ideologically centered on the right. While we have, you know, the more militant grassroots organizing remain too small in numbers. We need a large mass-based movement in order to create real change, you know, given the forces that we're up against. And I think the left has a real role to play to be a bridge between, you know, these two factions of the larger workers' movement in this country.
Thank you.
You're listening to Episode 10 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from Bhairavi Desai, founding member of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Next, the panelists respond to moderator questions. We'll hear first from Ajamu Baraka, then Bhairavi Desai, then Kali Okuno.
We seem to have both a political and a cultural challenge that we have to recognize and address. And that is, you know, I get a chance to get around this country, and I see there's a lot of good work being done. Everybody is organizing, but what we are defining as organizing seems quite different to me. I'm not seeing a lot of the old-fashioned face-to-face organizing in the kitchens and front rooms that I recognized before that also reflected effective organizing. And that's not happening, I think, because there's been a cultural shift in terms of the deterioration of civic life, that people are not socializing like we did some decades ago. People are not visiting one another. We don't have very many civic organizations. So the whole notion of how we, in fact, relate to people and build and deepen social relations is almost lost. And therefore, face-to-face organizing is almost becoming a lost art. So the challenge of having to build alternative structures and institutions, and that's what we're talking about. We talk about trying to build a revolutionary movement. We're talking about building alternative structures and institutions within the context of already existing dominant institutions. That's why the alternative. But we haven't been that effective at doing that. So I wonder, how do we address these cultural changes? How do we get to a point and a place where we can go back and do the kind of effective political education we used to do also? We can't even talk about, you know, why we need to be raising the issue of socialism when we can't even get access to the people. So when you have a more vibrant civic environment, then you see the consequence in terms of organizing. Very quick story. As many of you know, I spent a lot of my time in Colombia. And in that country, there's still a civic culture and a tradition of organizing. And so the standards and measurement of success is a lot different than what I see here. A couple of years ago, my partner, who's in the leadership of one of the main Afro-Colombian organizations, they went to meet with one of the local bureaucrats. And in that meeting, this was on a Wednesday afternoon, the folks were pretty disrespectful to the activists. And so the activist said, the bureaucrat. So the activist said, okay, so since you're not going to respect us and you're not going to respond to us correctly, we tell you what. Ain't nobody going home this afternoon. We're going to take this building. And they took the office and they took the building. It's on Wednesday evening. Friday morning, I talked to my partner and she was upset. because they put a call out. They said they wanted people to come and join them to occupy this building. So Friday morning, I talked to her. She said, "Yeah, I'm really upset." I said, "Why?" "Because we didn't get the kind of response that we should have." I said, "Well, how many people are inside the building?" She said, "We only got about 250 people." "And we got 30 people outside who are organizing the food." And I'm thinking, in this country, for us to mobilize in a day and a half 250 people, and you ain't sending people plane fares and tickets and stuff, it ain't going to happen. You know. But that's the kind of organizing that we've got to get to some kind of way.
I think you'll appreciate the story. About 2007, we went out on strike. And, you know, we don't have a strike fund, right? Drivers are considered independent contractors. There's no paychecks in the industry. And the way we organized the strike is there are all these friendship groups. And so for each group of, like, 20 drivers, one would be in charge of collecting all the keys for the taxi so that nobody could go out and, you know, scab for the day. Right? And we ended up having a strike of about 30,000 workers. And that's really how it got built up. I don't know if I'm as optimistic as to what's happening in this city. I mean, New York City now has the highest income inequality of any city in the country. And just, I mean, New York State has the highest of any state in the country as well. And just to give you a context of, like, the world that we work in terms of, you know, the gig economy, an average CEO makes, like, 271 times more, right, than their average employee salary in the overall economy. In the gig economy, an Uber driver that earns even $35,000 a year compared to the Uber CEO, the CEO makes 5,700 times more than that driver. And some of you may have heard over the past 5 months, we've had suicides by 5 drivers in New York City. 2 livery drivers, a black car driver, and 2 yellow cab driver. And, you know, these are all men in their late 50s and 60s. And it's the growing, you know, poverty that people are just facing every single day in this city. You're working 12, 14 hours a day. I think that's also part of why you don't have more of a civic society. People are just really exhausted. Right? Everyone is just working longer and, you know, you have less time available to you. And then on top of that, there's just more exhaustion. And hearing stories from workers at work 12, 14 hours, still talking about hunger, food scarcity, you know, not having enough for, you know, for healthcare, but just even the most basics of, like, being able to eat every day and not having to skip a meal as an adult. I think there's such a deepening poverty in our city. And I think part of the reason that you have lots of these like contradictions, as I would call them, is we still have a political environment where the movements that win are the ones that have political connections. It's the, you know, it's even on the grassroots level, you're expected to have a lobbyist. Right? Or you're supposed to have access to some lobbyists who might volunteer for you while, you know, others are kind of paying their bills. I mean, there's something fundamentally wrong with that kind of a politics. And even though we live in a city with, you know, one of the most progressive city councils, you know, almost exclusively all Democrats, it's still that same kind of politics that's expected. You still don't have a political leadership that recognizes certain inequities and feels a moral calling to legislate around those issues, even if there wasn't a grassroots effort that's pushing things along. And I know that might sound really, you know, unrealistic. We know that change only happens in the political arena when there's been a fight on the streets, and this fight on the streets only happens when people are being organized. But I do think that there is something to be recognized that, you know, that there's such a moral bankruptcy that on any kind of an issue of fairness, of, like, humanism, you know, in this day and age, it's not just a grassroots movement isn't even enough. You need access to lobbying and you need access to political money in order to be heard. And, you know, New York City still has that same kind of, business as usual politics. And I think that we need to find a way for, you know, the progressive movement in this city to really challenge that and, you know, and to bring about a new kind of politics where, you know, that doesn't depend on lobbyists. Like, even if it's lobbying from our side, that's still a problem. Hmm. It's still a problem if that's the only way that change really happens, right? It's still a problem where you have such a deepening poverty in this country that we have, you know, when you look at the numbers of like mass incarceration, you know, you look at the how much, you know, public education is fleeting and how many people in our communities have less and less access to it. These should be certain universal issues that particularly in a so-called progressive city with the progressive political bodies that these are issues that should be able to be taken up on their own without requiring, you know, the kind of movement work that it still does. Because that can't be our starting point, right? If these things don't get taken on by a political body that recognizes its moral responsibility, then these most basic issues, they remain our starting point. And so when we look at issues of inequality, the gaps just keep getting bigger and bigger. Because if all we're expected to talk about are, for example, issues of minimum wage, that's the floor. We shouldn't have to begin at a freaking floor. You know, if we're supposed to raise that ceiling, then this can't be where we start things off. And so we need to find a way of, you know, changing the political structure so that we're not constantly beginning here. And so, you know, that there's a higher calling at play.
I think we need to dispel part of this notion that Trump represents something new.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That's
true.
That's number one. Them folks been here. They ain't ever gone nowhere, you know. And I think we act with a degree of amnesia in remembering that David Duke and many others like him were elected officials in the 1980s. And we forget that Ronald Reagan, when he announced his presidency in 1979, he did that in Mississippi at the site where Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner were executed,
exactly.
Sending a clear message to the white folks, particularly in the South, who he was, what he was about, what he was prepared to do, and what alliances that he was anchoring himself in. Now, the difference, that if you want to say that there was a difference in the world between then and now, that racist bullshit on a certain level was contained because there was the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc and other countries that were still pertaining to be socialism that were counterweights to some of that madness on the international level. Mm-hmm. The other difference was you were still, you know, there were still active forces of resistance within the Black Liberation Movement, the Chicano Liberation Movement, the Puerto Rican Liberation Movement, the American Indian Movement that were on the ground here in the United States that were a living example and still engaged in certain types of resistance openly and affrontedly to the system that was going on. You don't have that now. Both of those forces are gone, right? Both of those forces are gone. Now, objectively, those movements are still with us to a certain extent. But we're not having no real conversation about resistance because that's one of the things, to a certain extent, let's be real, got eliminated in September 11th. Mm-hmm. See, I was part of an organization that we very deliberately, to a certain extent, stopped talking about socialism and national liberation and start just having this amorphous conversation about transformation because we were, to a certain extent, trying to play into the game of not being labeled a terrorist, knowing that's what was coming down after September 11th. So these dynamics have been creeping up on us because we allowed this bullshit to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, let's be real about that. And I think the last piece where I was saying about going down the rabbit hole, see, I think some of the confusion is not necessarily a confusion of the left, at least we can define, debate what that means, but at least how I see that entity, it's a small fraction of the United States society, number one. But I think our greatest confusion is that we keep trying to have an unprincipled alliance with liberals in this country. Yeah.
Exactly.
And we're not willing to challenge the liberals on a serious and hardcore basis, because in part, all of us to a certain extent have been on this stage, to my knowledge, or to a certain degree, and it's not just a criticism, this is objective reality that we face, but we now in a situation where the movement itself has been NGOized, and it's the liberals who are the foundation of the finance of that politic.
We get no money from any liberal NGO at all, Black Alliance for Peace.
Not bad, right? But I mean, but I'm saying in terms of the dynamic, we want to understand the politics that we have, you know, in this current moment and what its limitations are. We are in a certain relationship with liberals that is confining, and we need to deal with that reality. And we got to figure out a concrete strategy to work our way out of that. Mm-hmm. Right? And that comes what our movement's trying to figure out. I would argue in part, you know, was trying to be subtle about, we have to find some way in which, you know, we at least enable ourselves to produce, be able to reproduce our own organizers, right? Through the resources that we generate and we control, and whatever little means of production that we can control it in this day and age, so we're not dependent upon their largesse or their, you know, beneficence and then the limitations of the politics that come with that. We need to be able, in the ultimate run, to be able to tell them, like we tell the other side of the equation, the far right, where to go. And how to get there, right? And I think it's on that basis that the clarity that the folks have been, you know, been waiting for will emerge. And then the folks that you were talking about, Ajamu, who have fundamentally basically turned off from politics, because I would argue the vast majority of these people in this country, this is just my own belief, they ain't stupid. By no stretch of the imagination. But it's not like on a certain level, even within the left, we have the boldness backed up by a practice which says, I'm taking what, you know, we are collectively taking what is rightfully ours and what we have built, and we are asserting control of it. Since we're not having that conversation, and it's increment by increment, it winds up being, you just sound like a more radical version of the liberal I heard or the conservative I heard. What's the concrete difference between you and everybody else? And if you can't show a concrete difference, I'm not going, you know, most folks, I think, objectively are sitting there. I'm not going to sacrifice my time, energy, and ultimately my person fighting the system if I don't see that you are serious about winning and taking it to its final conclusion.
You've been listening to episode 10 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode features audio from the closing plenary of the 2018 Left Forum, held June 1st through 3rd in New York City, entitled A Vision Moving Forward, and includes talks by Ajamu Baraka, Kali Okuno, and Bhairavi Desai. You can find Other Voices, Other Choices on iTunes and YouTube. Thanks for listening.